You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today we return for part two of the most powerful chapter in a groundbreaking work, the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, detailing the first large-scale Jewish fake news operation in the United States, the Jewish power structure's attempt to prevent and then to reverse the murder conviction of Jewish sex killer Leo Frank. In order to do that, Jewish leaders and media figures and behind-the-scenes manipulators had to pay perjurers, plant false evidence, corrupt investigators, and bamboozle the public into believing that a despicable pervert and killer was really an innocent victim of supposed anti-Semitism. They hired an unscrupulous frontman to pretend to be working for the good guys. Sound familiar? And you're also going to hear today about the internal ADL report and its conclusion, never mentioned by them in their public pronouncements on the case, that the pro-Frank forces had indeed planted false evidence. Here is Miss Vanessa Neubauer to tell us exactly how they operated. Listen.
Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
They say you can't take on the man and win. That one small company doesn't stand a chance against the corporate behemoths with all their money and lawyers. But they don't know Harry's. How's Harry's done it? Simple. By owning the factory and selling directly to you. Harry's sells their incredible razor blades online. They ship directly from their site to you and do it for a lot less. And while those other guys rake in huge profits, Harry's passes the savings directly back to you. The result? A quality shave and more money in your pocket. Don't believe it? Try Harry's for yourself, for free. Just pay $3 in shipping when you sign up. Your set comes with a razor, shave gel, travel cover, and a post-shave balm. That's an almost $20 value, free. There's no catch and no commitment. You can cancel anytime. And quality is always guaranteed. So go to Harry's.com now and enter code 5000 at checkout. That's Harry's.com, code 5000. Again, 5000.
Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
In ancient times, man roamed the earth in a constant state of hunting or being hunted. Introducing Caveman, where cutting-edge science meets ancient super nutrients. Secure your bottle right now at InfoWarsStore.com.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your two-month supply, call now, toll-free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
Charge. Planted evidence. Description. An ADL report addresses the, quote, discovery, end quote, of Mary Fagan's pay envelope by a detective hired by Frank. Quote, the mysterious pay envelope, bearing not a single fingerprint of any kind, even a smudge, had to have been a plant. End quote. Charge. Bribery of Reverend C. B. Ragsdale. Description. The former pastor of a local church testified he was paid $200 for signing a false affidavit claiming he had overheard Conley confess to the murder. Charge. Forged letter of the dead Judge Roan. Description. A letter that appeared after the death of trial judge Leonard S. Roan, expressing doubt about Frank's guilt, was believed by his family and solicitor Dorsey to be forged by Frank's legal team. Charge. Forged affidavit. Description. Ivy Jones testified that Conley was not drunk on the day of the murder. Jones said his affidavit, to the contrary, was forged. Charge. Forged affidavit. Description. Ruth Robinson testified that Frank made an indecent proposal to her, but her testimony was retracted in a false affidavit by C. W. Burke. Charge. Forged affidavit. Description. Rabbi David Marks and Mrs. Leo Frank approached black food vendor Mary Rich and tried to force her to sign a false affidavit that helped Frank's alibi. She refused, but they submitted it anyway. Charge. Forged affidavit. Description. Mrs. J.B. Simmons was induced by C.W. Burke to sign a false statement against solicitor Hugh Dorsey. Burke brought her a basket of fruit in payment. This list is by no means the full extent of the criminal operations of the agents working on behalf of Mr. Leo M. Frank. Despite the scope and seriousness of these crimes, most were not adjudicated, and those responsible received only fines and no jail time. Burns had his license revoked. Burns's cohort, Dan Lehan, was expelled from Chicago Police Department for bribery and conduct unbecoming of an officer. Burns's agents, C.W. Burke and Jimmy Wren, appear to have gotten away scot-free. As incredible as all this sounds, Burns parlayed this sleazy resume into a directorship of the Federal Bureau of Investigation from 1921 until another scandal forced him to resign in 1924. Under oath and before Judge Hill, Solicitor Hugh Dorsey finally had the opportunity to question William J. Burns. Quote, during your investigation, what criminal act did you ever discover that Conley had committed? End quote. Answer. Quote, I don't know that I have discovered any. End quote. Leo Frank's massive criminal insurgency. In 1914, Leo Frank's forces unleashed a wave of criminality, the scope of which is unprecedented. The details of the operation were captured in rare fashion in this article. Beginning of newspaper article. Quote, return of Negress ordered by judge. End quote. By reporters of the Atlantic Constitution. May 5, 1914. Covering the trial of the agents and operatives of the William J. Burns Detective Agency. Return of Negress ordered by judge. If Anna Maud Carter is not in Atlanta within 5 days, her evidence will not be considered. Charges of bribery, perjury, and coercion of witnesses will be thoroughly investigated by Solicitor Dorsey, and then a number of prosecutions will follow, according to a statement by the solicitor on Monday night. Quote, prosecutions will certainly follow later on, end quote, he said. Quote, it will be my duty as a prosecuting officer to see that justice is done. Outside of that, I can say nothing else, except that the scope of my prosecutions will include all who have been guilty of crookedness, even the men higher up. End quote. Judge Ben Hill demanded of Leo Frank's defense yesterday afternoon that Anna Maud Carter, the Negro witness, be returned to the jurisdiction of the court within 5 days. He declared that if she were not brought back to Atlanta within that time, he would decline to consider her evidence or any evidence in which she was involved. Quote, Detective Burns admitted before me, end quote, said Judge Hill, quote, that he had sent Anna Maud Carter from the jurisdiction of the court. I want an order drawn commanding Anna Maud Carter to be returned to Atlanta in 5 days, or I will not consider any of the evidence in which she is concerned. End quote. A few minutes later, Judge Hill supplemented his statement with these words, quote, In making this demand, I do not mean to reflect on the counsel for Frank. It was testified before me that Detective Burns had removed the Carter woman. End quote. Will bring woman back. It is said that immediate efforts will be made to bring the missing woman back to Atlanta. She is now in New Orleans, where, according to a letter she recently wrote relatives in the city, she is working with the William J. Burns Detective Agency. This letter was read to Judge Hill by Solicitor Dorsey Monday afternoon. Anna Maud Carter is the negress who accuses Jim Conley of having confessed to her the murder of Mary Fagan. A literal mountain of evidence was introduced by the solicitor Monday to show that she had conspired with George and Jimmy Wren in Fulton Jail to frame up on Conley. Other testimony was adduced to show that she had told friends and relatives upon being released from jail that she had tried to, quote, pick, end quote, Conley, and that he had firmly maintained that Leo Frank was the murderer. Regarding the Carter woman, Attorney Arnold was asked by a reporter for the Constitution if lawyers for Frank or the Burns agents would seek to bring the woman back to the city. Mr. Arnold smiled in reply, saying that he did not know as yet. A surprising new phase of evidence that arose Monday was an affidavit from Mrs. Hattie Waits, the young wife of J. M. Waits, who swears that on the morning of the day Mary Fagan was slain, she saw Leo Frank and Jim Conley talking to each other sometime between 10 and 11 o'clock, and that they were apparently engaged in earnest conversation. This evidence was introduced to bear out in part that portion of Conley's testimony bearing with a meeting he swore he had with Frank on the morning of the 26th at Forsyth and Nelson Streets, when Frank is alleged to have instructed him to come to the pencil factory that noon to, quote, watch, end quote, for him. Mrs. Waite's affidavit has been kept a secret by the solicitor and created a sensation when it was sprung. Lehan nears contempt. At the very outset of the retrial proceedings Monday morning, a sensation was created when Dan S. Lehan, Southern Superintendent of the William J. Burns Forces, was practically put under arrest for contempt of court. Following the strenuous examination which he underwent before Solicitor Dorsey, he made a heated tirade against the solicitor's tactics. They were cut short by Judge Hill, however, who ordered him to cease, and who instructed Deputy Sheriff Plenty Minor to take charge of the Burns man. Minor escorted Lehan into an adjoining room, where he remained for some little while. Later, Judge Hill asked the court stenographer to read that part of Lehan's statement, which attacked Dorsey. Attorneys Arnold and Rosser stated that the witness had not intended to be in contempt. Judge Hill ordered the words expunged from the record, called Deputy Minor into the room, and ordered that Lehan be allowed to go his way. Only two witnesses were examined, Lehan and L. P. Eubanks. Mary Rich, the negress who was alleged by the defense to have made an affidavit in which she stated she saw Jim Conley emerge from the rear of the pencil plant at 2:15 o'clock on the tragedy date, has made an affidavit in which she denies having made the document submitted by the defense. Refused to sign paper. Quote, Sometime recently, end quote, she swears, quote, Mrs. Lucille Frank and Rabbi Marks and two men came to see me and tried to get me to make an affidavit. The affidavit was not true, and I refused to sign it. Mrs. Frank said to me, If you will sign this affidavit, you will take the rope from around my husband's neck. I replied that I could not tell a lie and that to sign the paper would be telling a lie. One man with Mrs. Frank and Rabbi Marks tore off a little piece of the paper that was in his hands. This man was C.W. Burke. He said, "You take this paper." I told him that I didn't want the paper, and he said, "This will not hurt you, but you keep this paper. It is just for you, so that you will know it when you see it again." I took it and kept it. I showed it in a few minutes afterward to Mr. F. J. Wellborn, a man that I have known a good long time, who was standing by when these people were talking to me. Afterwards, I took the paper to somebody in the office of Solicitor General Hugh N. Dorsey. I have looked at the piece of paper attached to the affidavit signed by F. J. Wellborn, and it looks to me to be about the size and shape of the paper which Burke gave me. Burke also told me that if I got into trouble, I might know the cause of it. End quote. Dorsey presented a number of affidavits dealing with an alleged conspiracy within the county jail between Anna Maud Carter and Dr. George Wren and Wren's brother, Jimmy Wren, to, quote, frame up, end quote, on Jim Conley. Dr. George Wren was a prisoner serving sentence for complicity in the Gilsey Diamond robbery. One angle of this evidence is an affidavit from Frank Reese, an ex-prisoner, who lives at 7 Kingsley Street. He was a trustee prisoner in the tower, worked in the prison laundry, and did odd jobs required of trustees. Quote, "I have heard Dr. Wren telling Conley that he had been tried, and that he, Conley, could take the Mary Fagan murder on himself and that it would free Mr. Frank," end quote, said Reese. Quote, "and that Conley could never be tried any more for it. Conley refused to consider this." End quote. Saw them talking. Quote, "Wren talked to Fred Perkerson, another prisoner, and myself several times, and tried to get us to agree to go into Conley's cell and come out, and claim that Conley had confessed to us. He said we would get lots of money if we did. I knew Annie Maud Carter, and I have seen her and Dr. Wren talking together very often. I saw Annie Maud Carter go to Conley's cell once, and Fred Perkerson called to her that if she went in, she would be locked up. Both Fred and I knew she was crooked, and we cautioned Jim Conley about her. I saw Dr. Wren at one time throw a note to Annie Maud Carter from the second floor. She carried it to Conley's cell, pitching it through the bars at the wing door. When I got out of jail, Dr. Wren came to my house one morning at 7 o'clock with a long white paper, asking me to sign it. I cannot read or write, and I told him I wanted to wait to see what was in the paper. He said that it was just a paper to the effect that I had carried notes from Jim Conley to Annie Maud Carter. I did not know what was in it, and so I wouldn't sign it. He said that, inasmuch as I couldn't write, he'd write it for me. I told him I wouldn't authorize anybody to write for me, nor sign my name to anything unless I was aware of its contents." End quote. Fred Perkerson, the prisoner alluded to in the Reeves affidavit, has signed a statement to the effect that C.W. Burke, the private investigator attached to Luther Z. Rosser's office, and Jimmy Wren, Burr's assistant, and Dr. George Wren, the convict named in Reeves' affidavit, have often conferred with Leo Frank in Frank's cell in the tower. He told a similar story of alleged conspiracy in which Wren figured to frame up on Conley. He swears that Wren told him and Reeves that they were in a position to make a lot of money, and advised them to go into Conley's cell and, upon coming out, pretend that Conley had confessed Mary Fagan's murder. He declares that he asked Wren why Wren himself didn't do this. Wren is said to have replied that he didn't care to get mixed up in the case. Ivy Jones, the Negro from whom the defense, in its new trial motion, purported to have obtained an affidavit recanting his testimony at the trial, has made an affidavit for the solicitor swearing that the defense affidavit is false and that it is a forgery. Dorsey attacked the defense argument that the notepaper on which Conley wrote the murder notes was obtained from the basement, when he introduced a number of affidavits in rebuttal. One of these was from Philip Chambers, an ex-office boy in Frank's employ, who was a witness for the defense at Frank's trial. Nothing sent to basement. Chambers testifies now that Becker, upon leaving the employ of the pencil factory, moved his desk into Mr. Frank's office, and that it was thereafter used by Frank. He swears that no trash, books, or paper ever stayed down in the basement, and that all order blanks left upon Becker's departure were used by Frank. J.M. Gant makes an affidavit in this phase to the effect that the order blanks were never destroyed, and at no time did he ever see any of the scratch pads sent in the trash to the basement. The trash, Gant swears, was burned with all rubbish every day in the furnace in the basement. Another affidavit bearing on this angle was one made by H.H. Otis, city fire inspector, who declares he was forced at numerous times to remind Leo Frank of negligence in keeping the basement regulated in compliance with fire ordinances. He instructed that all trash and rubbish be burned each day. He swears that he heard Frank give Darley, the assistant superintendent, specific instructions to burn all refuse and to see that none of it remained unburned in the basement, or anywhere in the factory building. Otis further testifies that such litter was burned under his personal supervision from April 1, 1913. R. M. DeVore, a photographic expert attached to the A.K. Hawks Optical Concern, has made an affidavit swearing that he photographed the murder notes for Solicitor Dorsey, and that he used a special color plate for the task, sending north for it. He says that, in his opinion, the number on the disputed blank is 1818. He also swears that T.A. Alexander, who recently issued a booklet bearing on the notes, admitted to him that he had instructed the photo engraver who made the plates to, quote, touch them up, end quote, a bit. Much interest was centered around the J.E. Duffy affidavit, which was submitted by Dorsey during the afternoon. Duffy, who is purported by the defense to have renounced his trial testimony, now upholds it and swears that he was induced by agents of the defense to make the recanting document. He says that L.P. Eubanks, the car inspector whom Dorsey grilled on the stand Monday morning, and C.W. Burke had offered him money to sign a false paper, and told him that, whenever he wanted money, they would furnish him with it. He swears that he has borrowed in the neighborhood of $30 from Eubanks. Quote, on April 30th of this year, end quote, his affidavit reads, quote, Jimmy Wren took me in an automobile over the city, carrying me to dinners and cafes and to shows, and then riding me toward Austell, Georgia. I slept all night in the automobile. They brought me back the next day, and when we stopped in front of the Marietta Chair Works on Marietta Street, we were surrounded by a crowd of Jews, who pressed me with many questions bearing on my testimony. End quote. Lent Duffy money. R. E. Duffy, father of Duffy, has made a statement saying that Eubanks had told him that he was lending young Duffy money, and taking his note for same, but that the father need not worry, as his son would never have to pay it back. Young Duffy has been released from prison, in which he was lodged Friday night on an attachment issued by Judge Hill.
You've been listening to Miss Vanessa Neubauer, presenting part two of A Century of Jewish Lies. Just one of 29 audio segments of this groundbreaking work originally published on the American Mercury, which is based on the Nation of Islam book series called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. Volume 3 is entitled The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. It will take you on a trip into the past to the greatest American murder mystery of all time, a mystery that will reveal to you the hidden forces that shape our world even today. Be with us again next week for part 3 of A Century of Jewish Lies, right here on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. The National Alliance is working to educate white men and women around the world as to the nature of the reality we must face, and organizing our people to ensure our survival and advancement. We need your help to continue. Please send the largest contribution you can afford to National Alliance, Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. You can also help us by visiting natall.com/donate. Once again, that address is Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to never give up.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will toil. Heaven is born on the earth.
You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
Tragedy introduced us to the heroes of San Bernardino's police department. But tragedy is routine in their city, where politicians slash their budget and cut their ranks. Now violent gangs wage bloody turf wars every night. They have all the guns they want, but law-abiding California citizens live in fear. Their governor says he serves them, while he releases 2,300 convicted murderers back to the same streets they terrorize. The elites lecture about compassion, but if there was even an inkling that these killers would head for Beverly Hills or Berkeley, they'd die behind bars. The elites and their families will always be protected. It's the law-abiding average Californians who face nightfall alone, with their faith and what's left of their guns. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National Socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kinds of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with the conservatives, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just at dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this. National socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us, are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker, nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. There's no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life just like here could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, antisocial doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Send them, let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books, and the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of us, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a butt. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people, and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.